This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and let's jump right into our week in review, beginning with a new approach to the opioid addiction crisis by the Gloucester Police, who want to help pave the way for drug addicts to get treatment instead of prison.
It's not a crime to be addicted to something. The ancillary crimes that revolve around it are really not the root of the problem.
Also this week, what did Tom Brady know, and when did he know it? Hard to say, because he's not talking about an NFL report that says he likely knew about underinflated footballs in the AFC Championship game.
It's only been 30 hours. So I haven't had much time to digest it fully, but when I do, I'll be sure to let you know how I feel about it.
Plus, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh's new project to imagine what Boston should look like in 15 years.
This is about master planning the entire city or looking at comprehensive planning the whole city. I think 2024, the plan, if we were to host the Olympics, would fit into certain pieces of this, but certainly not the whole plan.
And former MBTA General Manager Beverly Scott says it's time for the state to take over the beleaguered agency. Joining us to talk about this and the rest of the week's news is John Carroll. He's a Boston University communications professor and a senior news analyst here at WBUR. John, good to have you.
Good to be here.
And Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Jim, it's always good to see you.
It's good to be with you.
So let's start with Gloucester Police Chief Leonard Campanella. We spoke to him yesterday, who announced this week on Facebook that any addict who walks into the police station with their drug equipment or drugs and asks for help will not be arrested. Instead, volunteers, what he calls his angels, will help them access addiction treatment. Here's Chief Campanello yesterday on Radio Boston. He says police can't arrest their way out of the opioid crisis.
We know that we haven't really gotten too far on the supply end. We can take a drug dealer down and three will replace him. And that drug dealer that's taken off the street does not affect the user at all and does not affect the addict at all. And we now also know that addiction in and of itself is not a crime.
So, Jim, a big shift away from the traditional approach, and there's a police chief. He describes himself as a tough law and order guy. He says he's not a squishy liberal, but he says we can't arrest our way out of this problem. What do you think of his approach?
I think he's absolutely right, and it's one of the things that gives me a lot of hope on this issue, which is it's not really an ideological divide. I think everyone understands that we have a lot of prison and jail beds, probably not enough detox beds, and that we've been incarcerating folks who, frankly, need treatment for way too long. What gives me especially a lot of hope in hearing Chief Campanello is, look, this, I know that Governor Baker has underway a task force and they're going around the state trying to hear ideas. This is a great opportunity here from local folks who are trying new stuff out because they're finding their local jails are too full and they're not actually showing any progress. So this is one of these ground up efforts where you can actually see programs that work and maybe the state can actually develop a pretty good program to support those local programs.
You know, we were reading yesterday about a pilot program in Seattle called LEAD for Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion. And basically police offer non-violent drug offenders. They get them paired up with a caseworker to help them get treatment, stable housing, job training. The four-year program is nearing its end, and it's already proven to reduce recidivism among nonviolent drug offenders by 60%. So this stuff is sort of working its way in the system out there. Do you see this, John, as something dramatic here in Massachusetts?
I think it could be dramatic. I think it would be a nice test case. I think they've thought it through pretty well up in Gloucester. They have a system in place whereby if an addict comes in, turns in his illegal drugs, his needles, paraphernalia, et cetera, they will do something immediately. They will have someone assigned to him immediately to get him into the system, to try to facilitate his path toward recovery. Mm-hmm. I think that's smart. They've also entered into agreements with local drugstores to provide Nalnicarn, I think. It's a drug that helps people kick the opioid habit. So
right.
I think overall it's a pretty enlightened approach, and it certainly seems to be a very popular approach because the chief announced this on Facebook, and if you look at all the comments on Facebook from local people,
yeah, they were overwhelmingly positive.
Absolutely. Yeah. So there's not a sort of law and order backlash here that's going on. I think that people see this as something that has real potential.
Yeah, as he described it to us yesterday, it's a real sort of paradigm shift among law enforcement. I'm wondering though about the paradigm shift on the other side, and that is for it to work. People who are addicted are going to have to feel comfortable walking into a police station. What do you think, Jim? Isn't that sort of a challenge, I guess?
It is a challenge, and that was the big question I had with the proposal. Look, As I was mentioning, this is not a plug for my organization, but we just went through a process. We collected 150 ideas on how to work on reentry and treatment for addicts. It is amazing to me to watch the level of innovation at the local level. And if it doesn't work the first time, the thing I'd say is this: the chief is going to find a different way around this, right? He may not ask them to walk into the police station. He may actually work with Bay Cove or one of the other providers in the local area of human services. They'll find a way towards this. The thing is, the will is there, and that's the important part.
Mm. Well, let's move on. I say somewhat reluctantly because I'm of two minds of whether this story matters, but it's certainly in the news. And this is Deflategate, the report by the NFL that the Super Bowl champion New England Patriots might, probably are cheaters. The long-awaited Ted Wells report came out Wednesday. Investigators didn't necessarily find a smoking gun that proved the Patriots deliberately let air out of game day footballs during the AFC Championship game. But the report did say it's more probable than not that at least two Patriots staff members deflated the footballs and that Tom Brady, their star quarterback, was generally aware of these activities. So here's Brady speaking to sportscaster Jim Gray during an event at Salem State University last night.
When do you plan to address this publicly?
Hopefully soon. Hopefully soon. There's still a process that's going forth right now, and I'm involved in that process. So whenever it happens, it happens, and I'll certainly want to be very comfortable in how I feel about the statements that I make.
All right, so there's Tom Brady talking yesterday. John, I'll start with you. Where are we with this? What do you think? What does this do to the Patriots? Is this a slam dunk? Do we refer to them as cheaters? How do you make sense of this?
Well, this is a Rorschach test, right? I mean, there's two universes out there. There's a universe that is inclined to believe this and a universe that is inclined to disbelieve this. One of the problems for the NFL is this report, 243 pages, has more hedging going on than Wall Street. Yeah. It's really...
It's more probable than... Not.
Exactly. Right. It's so mushy at this point. It gives people ammunition. It gives people sort of permission to disbelieve it. Tom Brady, his strategy is really interesting here because I think he's basically taking the golden boy strategy, which is I'm popular enough and I'm secure enough that I don't have to deal with this at all. And I think that he's not going to come forward and be open about this. I think he's going to be very guarded. His agent put out a statement that said this is outrageous, didn't say it wasn't true, said it's outrageous. And I think that Brady's just going to try to tough his way through and hope that it sort of melts away. I think the NFL is in a difficult position here because I don't think they've got a lot that's really rock solid in terms of what they're basing this on.
Not a lot that's rock solid. There are some facts, though, that sort of jump out at me. For instance, this. Patriots staffer Jim McNally, who refers to himself in text messages as the deflator, okay, left the locker room with footballs for both the Colts and the Patriots, then went into a bathroom with footballs and came out 2 minutes later. And there's, a lot of evidence that Brady spoke on the phone and texted with another Patriots staffer. I mean, that's very circumstantial. But anyway, Jim, what's your view? As mushy as John sees it, or what do you think's going on here?
Well, the universe that John referred to ends somewhere around Hartford.
And,
right. I think what we found is within that universe at Salem State University, the interviewer was actually booed for just asking some basic questions. So I think the Kraft family will tough it out and they'll do fine. No season ticket holders are going to give up their seats. And I think the Golden Boy strategy is precisely what Tom Brady's doing. But I'd say a couple of things. One is what I discovered in this process that everything in America is good. And we're all happy because if we can sit around and debate this for hours on end, the economy must be great. There must be no people unemployed. It must be all happiness. A little more seriously, look, for a kid who watches this, if there isn't some closure on this, I think it's just a bad thing for kids who look up to people. I'm not saying that Brady's guilty. He's not guilty, but he's going to have to clarify. Yeah. He has a duty to clarify, I think. And one of the things that comes to my mind is this. It seemed to me there's so much innuendo and pushing of the envelope in that report. And partly it's because they were frustrated by not getting the information they wanted or they were looking for, let's say, if they had a preconceived notion. They're trying to push the Patriots, the NFL, and Tom Brady into a corner. I think they're trying to push the NFL into the corner where they actually have to suspend him. I really wonder what the Patriots and Tom Brady do in that case. Mm-hmm. Tom Brady, I don't think, could go back and sue. If he did, he'd open himself up to discovery. they'd have access to all kinds of documentation, that sort of scenario, a very bad outcome for him. So it's a really weird place to be.
It is a weird place to be, but you raise some really, really interesting questions. I mean, if they are moving towards suspension, what does Tom Brady do? What can he do? And as you say, then it becomes a legal proceeding and gets really, really complicated.
I think he starts a Kickstarter fund.
Yeah, not sure he needs that. All right, let's move on to Boston 2030. This is Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, who wants to Bostonians to think big about the future. The mayor is launching a new initiative to come up with a plan of what the city should look like in 2030. Here he is.
It's about what's Boston going to look like. If we want to grow as a city and we want to get to 700,000 people and we want to continue to grow, some of those challenges are going to have to be met.
So Walsh wants residents to weigh in on everything from housing and jobs to open spaces and culture. There are no concrete details yet. But, Jim, what do you think of this? Too ambitious? Too broad? Right direction? Wrong direction? What do you make of it?
The quote you just had from the mayor told me one thing really powerful, very powerfully, about his vision. He wants to grow Boston.
Yeah.
And he's wanted to for quite some time. I think this is a wonderful initiative, whether it's, you know, brought about because of an interest in the Olympics or not. This is really what should have preceded the Olympic effort. And that is a ground-based, a grassroots effort to go and talk to people, force neighborhoods to talk to other neighborhoods, find out what they want their city to look like. It's a very healthy, open-ended. They're not going to come to one conclusion around it, but it's a great thing for the city to think about. Mm. I know it can be a maddening process, but, you know, things like Seaport's booming, Southie's changing. What do the people in Southie want their neighborhood to look like? Or think about Mission Hill. You've got the Baptist that's probably going to move. They're going to do some sort of construction in Longwood again. What do we do about all that traffic in Longwood? What's Mission Hill going to look like after the departure? These are really great questions, especially in a booming time. The only other thing I'd say is I wish it happened before, but I understand fully it could not have happened before because we were in a recession. The city is poised because of its success to do this now, and I think it's great.
It's interesting, John. It's sort of like a similar set of questions that have been raised around Boston's Olympic bid without the controversy of the Olympic bid.
Right. Well, first of all, I'd be a lot more comfortable if there were a Boston 2016. because, honestly,
2030,
I mean, I hope,
getting a little ahead of ourselves,
I hope
we
all make it to 2030. I truly do. The other thing is this is going to be great for caterers because there are going to be so many meetings. I think one of the problems here is people getting tangled up in too much forward thinking. I'm worried about what's going on now. I'm worried about them losing sight of what we need to do in the immediate future as opposed to these milestones. It's all well and good, and I don't think it's a bad idea, but I think that there's a limited amount of time, there's a limited amount of energy, limited number of resources, and I worry that it's going to be harder now to juggle all those things because of this sort of farsighted focus that Marty Walsh has adopted.
Well, Jim, keeping that in mind, I mean, that there are a lot of immediate demands. I mean, the MBTA, which we're going to talk about in a minute, is one. But given all the sort of immediate demands, what would be the most important element that we should be considering as we look forward? I mean, what would be on top of your list?
On top of my list is transportation.
Yeah.
I really think this whole look, if we want localities to talk to each other, to interact with each other, for folks to have access to jobs, it is all about transportation. And the other thing that's premised on transportation is how high do we want to go in which neighborhoods? Because the mayor has been bullish on that. He, as I said before, he wants to grow the city. If you want to grow the city, what does that mean specifically for those neighborhoods? So I'd say those are the two top ones. And if there's a third one, it's the retail spines that fall within the city, what you want to do with those. But the first two are probably much more important because they define that last question.
Well, we're going to be taking on this question about the future of Boston, what it should look like, what is Boston 2030 and the mayor's vision. We're going to be talking about this on Monday with members of the Walsh administration and some other folks who think deeply about this. We're hoping to get the mayor himself, but that has yet to be nailed down. But anyway, that's coming up Monday on Radio Boston. So more on this on Monday. So let's move on and talk about transportation. The MBTA, former MBTA General Manager Beverly Scott, is calling for further action. In an interview with Commonwealth Magazine this week, Scott said the T needs to be put out of its misery, and she says the state should take over the agency rather than having it exist as a quasi-public authority. Jim, we've talked to you about this. This is an idea that you would favor, right?
It is not.
It is not.
It is not.
I have
not.
That wrong.
No, no. We proposed a finance control board. I'll explain why. First thing I'd just like to say is Beverly Scott.
Yeah.
If you look at the internal documents of her tenure, it really tells a story that's very interesting. She tried to do some really hard things in that agency, and that's a conversation for another day, how she got stopped in that. I'd say she's right about the need for a state takeover, but the wrong vehicle. It should not be a line agency, because if you bring it in as a line agency that reports to the governor, you have to change all the financial arrangements that exist there. All the opportunities for understanding apples-to-apples comparison as to whether you're improving things or not go away. It opens up all kinds of problems. That's why we proposed a short-term control board, keeps the same structure of the finances and all the rest in place, but allows us in an emergency fashion to have additional powers to address issues. Things like, if Kielis isn't working well, we can reopen that contract. Or the ride. No one's talked about the ride to date, the paratransit system. They're providing a service at 3 times the cost of a very comparable system that's already existing in Massachusetts. It's crazy. They're wasting $65 million a year. That's the kind of thing we should go at bullet shots. Doing this would just really undo all kinds of arrangements and throw us into a lot of chaos, I think.
John, what's your view on what Beverly Scott is proposing here?
I think that I'm not a think tank guy like Jim, so I'm just like a tea rider.
Yeah.
And it's the worst in the world. It's absolutely the worst. I think that that they have to go in and look at what they're doing now and say, why are we not doing the things that we should have been doing all along? Why is there $2 billion sitting on the table that we should have spent on improvements on the T that we didn't spend on improvements on the T? And also to take a look at the fares. And I say this as a rider. You know, the fares have to go up. There's just no other way to deal with this. Down in New York, they have what they call the pizza index. And the fares, subway token, has risen in tandem with the cost of a slice of pizza. I think that we should go to a really fancy pizza place, figure out what a slice is, and then set the fare at that level. Because
Couldn't we peg it to like a bowl of clam chowder? Just to make it
we could, to make it more regional. Yeah,
right,
okay.
Yeah. Right, good, I like that. So... but actually, you raise an issue that we can talk about seriously here. I mean, former State Transportation Secretary Jim Aloisi, we've had him in a couple of times, among others, have argued that what the T really needs is not a control board, but more money. So, Jim, what about the funding issues at the T?
Well, look, costs are spiraling out of control. Adding more money right now doesn't make a lot of sense. But long term, Jim is wrong in the short term, but in the long term, he's right. Our proposal has always been that we put into control board, we undertake emergency reforms to address those issues that John is talking about. And then later on, we have to take some of the debt load away from the T, which is, in essence, an infusion of cash, but gradually in a way that rewards the reforms they would undertake. Just giving them more money right now, they couldn't push it out the door, Anthony. They just couldn't push it out the door. So why think that more money is the solution now? Later on, this state needs to invest in its infrastructure once we get our arms around the T.
All right. So some reform first, then investment. Sounds like that's the sort of order of business here. Okay, gentlemen, we have just enough time for our hubbubs, those stories that fell below the fold this week, but that caught your attention. John, let me start with you. What's your hub?
Well, you know, they say it's not over until Chris Christie sings. So.
Is that what they say?
Absolutely. In my neighborhood, anyway. So here's Chris Christie on, just to put the come full circle on Deflategate. Here's what he said about Tom Brady. So I think that the media and others love for somebody who is married to a beautiful model, who is richer than you can imagine, and who is a future Hall of Famer, to take a couple of shots at him. People like that every once in a while. I think it's way, way overblown. Okay, for starters, I'll give $10 to anybody who can diagram that first sentence. But secondly, Chris Christie saying something is overblown is like Bill Belichick saying someone's tight-lipped. It just doesn't work. On the other hand, I'm sure that Tom is really happy that the New Jersey governor is in his corner.
Now, just to be clear, when he said this, he was in New Hampshire, right? And he certainly doesn't want to risk upsetting anyone.
I'm sure he does not. So even though he's a rabid Philadelphia Eagles fan, or no, he's
probably a Giants fan.
He's a Giants fan, right? Yeah. Right. Doesn't go over well in Jersey.
Okay. Jim, you're a hobo.
Well, I was just going to say that it sounded like the golden boy he was referring to was this governor in New Jersey took a few shots for closing down a bridge or something. But mine is a backup plan for the Olympics in case they don't make it across the finish line. It's called Slide the City, and it is a 1,000-foot water slide created by a Utah-based events company. Like the Olympics, it will be decomposable. The Slide the City is the largest slip and slide on asphalt. Boston Magazine notes that according to the company, there is no reason to worry because it is powered by recirculating water and it has, quote, more cushion than your grandpa's orthopedic sneakers. Without a specific Boston location, 4,000 Bostonians, yes, we are crazy, have already signed up for this happening.
All right. That sounds great. Okay, here's my hubbub. It's about opera music, an opera lover in an unexpected place. Cue the music. All right, so this is David Wan. He drives an Uber cab, and he was playing Pavarotti in his cab when he picked up Quincy entrepreneur Jeff Sullivan last week. Sullivan asked him if he liked opera music, and Wan started to sing. Not bad, right? So Jeff Sullivan recorded this on his smartphone, but it gets better. It turns out that Jeff Sullivan is a close friend with the famous Irish tenor Ronan Tynan, and he helped arrange a meeting between the two, and that resulted in a singing lesson given by Ronan Tynan to Uber cab driver Mr. Wan. And I think that's a very
more bad news for the taxi cab industry, huh?
John, always looking for the negative side. What can I say? All right, gentlemen, thank you both very much. John Carroll, BU Professor of Communication, thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.
You too.
And Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute. Thank you, Jim.
It's good to be with you.
Listeners, stay with us. Just ahead, a conversation with Sister Helen Prejean. She tells about the mistakes she made when she first took up her fight against the death penalty. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Stay with us.